Please turn to page 87 of the instruction booklet.
Welcome to episode 11 of the instruction booklet. I'm your host, Jeremy, and I'm joined always by a man who believes that, you know, I guess it's all just porn. And that would be my co-host, Michael. Michael, what's going on?
Yeah, what's going on? What Jeremy is making a joke about here is that recently I was a guest on another podcast. A friend of mine, Melissa, she has a podcast called In Bed With Books, where she talks about a lot of sort of like book talk, bookstagram, dark fantasy kind of content. And there was an ongoing joke where she was talking about on the podcast how a lot of people like to characterize that particular genre as porn, you know. Sarah J. Maas books and stuff like that.
It cracked me up because my brain immediately went to the spaceman thing. It's all porn. Always has been.
Always has been.
Yeah. So
check out her podcast, by the way. It's a really good episode.
I'm fairly certain I linked it on our Facebook as well as our Twitter. So yeah, it's really good. I watched it today while I was chilling at work.
Yeah. So, she will be joining us at some point on here as well. Whenever we can figure that out.
Somewhere in the far distant future, we will have guests on this show. But yeah, so anyway, I guess as always, we have been gone for a little bit longer than we anticipated. I had a vacation, I had company here, and Michael's been globetrotting and writing a dissertation. So I guess in the time since our last episode, what all you been playing, what all you been reading, you know, the et cetera, which you've been up to lately, Michael?
Yeah. Well, as you kind of just said, I've been working a lot on my dissertation this month, as well as the fact that I actually had a conference presentation to do in March. So I had a very busy month, which is one of the reasons why it was hard to try and schedule our recording. But recently, in addition to Tekken, because I've been playing a lot of Tekken 8 and that game is very good.
Yeah,
I've been playing Dave the Diver the past few days, trying to unwind with a little bit of a cozy game, having gotten my work done. And it's been wonderful. I mean, just such a well-crafted and serotonin-inducing gameplay loop.
Yeah.
Very, very simple. I mean, you know, you're a diver, you own a sushi restaurant, and then you run your social media page for the restaurant. You dive, you catch fish during the day, and then during the night, you go back to your restaurant, you cook sushi, and you just have a good time. And, nice. And one of the things that's amazing about the game is just how it evolves over time to get more and more complicated. Mm-hmm. Like, after a while, you'll have somebody who starts a fish farm for you, and then you could start growing vegetables as well. And then also, you have a food critic who likes your restaurant so much that they open up a branch location for you, and you have to hire, like, you know, people to work the branch location. It is hilariously wacky.
Yeah.
But also just an incredibly good game. So.
Kind of reminds me of, did you ever play Moonlighter?
I have not.
It's like a rogue-like dungeon crawling game where, like, at night you go into the dungeon to retrieve items, and during the day you, like, run like an RPG style equipment shop.
Oh, that sounds cool.
Yeah, this is a lot of fun. I think they made, like, an expansion for it. I picked it up on sale one time because I'd heard a lot of things about it, so
I'll have to check it out at some point, maybe.
Yeah. Anything you've been watching or reading?
Anything I've been watching or reading. My inability to think of anything makes me want to say no.
Gotcha.
Oh, Invincible. I mean, Invincible's been good.
Gotcha.
But other than that, not much. X-Men. X-Men 97.
I have yet to watch that. It's on my list.
Yeah. And then I guess the TV show for the Three-Body Problem came out. I haven't watched it yet. I'm a huge fan of the book. And so I'm hesitant because I'm concerned. I'm sure it's going to be. I mean, I've heard good things.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's just how it goes.
Sweet.
What about you?
I've been playing Helldivers. Duh. Sure. Been playing that. I recently got back into playing the Pokemon TCG. I've been playing the online version because apparently they just want you to be able to play the game and they give you pretty much all the cards. So that's cool. Been doing that. When my company was here, I got back into playing Guilty Gear Strive and found out that Elfell Valentine is a blast to play. So I've been kind of getting back into that. It's been kind of interesting going, like, because I'd been playing Street Fighter for so long and then going back to Strive.
Sure.
Despite it being different, it's kind of like refreshing to pick up a game you sort of know and like take some of the things you've learned from other fighting games and apply them to this. So that's been like a fun like moment of like clarity of being like, oh, I've gotten kind of better at this game, even though I haven't touched it in a while. So I've been playing that. I read a lot of manga recently. I caught up on One Punch Man, which I know that's been done, but I read the manga too. I picked up the new book from the creator of Full Metal Alchemist. Has a new book called Daemons of the Shadowlands. It's a very good first volume. I definitely want to pick up some more of it to see how it kind of plays out. I like the premise and the story. I've been reading some other stuff too. Oh, I've been reading the new Ultimate Spider-Man book from Jonathan Hickman. It's been great.
Cool.
I'm trying to think what else I've been reading. So I've been working on a couple. I've been doing a lot more reading lately. Because like at night, I'll like go and just chill on my love seat and just kind of read to kind of like wind down from the day. So I've been finishing up MASH. I watched the entirety of the first season of Zom 100, which was a surprisingly good little anime that like takes a fun twist on like the zombie genre. Like, you know, like most times like zombie stuff like tends to like focus on more like about the societal collapse and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
This one's more like the guy's working a dead end job and hates his life. And then when the zombie apocalypse happens, he realizes that he doesn't have to go to work anymore and writes down a list of 100 things he wants to do before he becomes a zombie. So it's like a fun, like more upbeat kind of thing. So that was neat. That's cool. Yeah. Outside of that, I haven't gone to see Godzilla vs. Kong yet. I'm hoping to do that this weekend. I'm trying to think. I saw Dune 2.
Oh yeah, same. Obviously, yeah.
Super pretty movie. Like, all the acting. I think we kind of had this like brief discussion where it's like I never read the books, so like the back half of the movie gets kind of wonky for me.
Sure.
As someone who's never read the books, as to where like I'm sure like people who have read the books probably felt a little bit better about it. So.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I'm a huge fan of the books. I understand how it could be very easy maybe to get confused or lost in this film because Villeneuve really kind of makes it dreamlike in a way. I mean, it's constantly going back and forth between, you know, perspectives, and it's interesting. I liked the movie a lot. I think there are some changes that were made from the book that are actually very smart.
Yeah.
And work fine.
I think for someone who's never read the books, I think the first one works better.
Yeah.
I liked the first one, but I'm also like Oscar Isaac's like my dog.
Yeah.
So
it is a good choice for Leto.
Yeah. Anyway, I guess much on catching up, we're going to, I guess, get into like the bulk of the episode now. So today we're actually going to be getting into some of the history stuff. We're going to be talking about the golden age of video games. And we're going to be going over a lot because there seems to be a lot of stuff that happens in this period that can't really like if we did it in like smaller chunks, we would have smaller episodes, so it was easier for us to kind of like combine it all into like one episode. Because this is kind of like, I guess it's like the lull before the storm, I guess, wouldn't you say?
Like, yes, I mean, this is the moment before. We're leading up to the crash. We're getting to the crash. We've been getting to the crash. We are actually getting to the crash now. But this is kind of the precursor to the big video game industry crash, at least in the U.S.
Yeah.
This period from like 78 to around 83, where the video game industry just seems like it's, you know, nowhere but up.
Yeah. Unfortunately, if only they'd known. So, yeah. So we're going to go over that today. We'll probably be covering a wide variety of topics. So, you know, just kind of stick with us, and then, yeah, we'll see where it goes from here. So, yeah. So the actual golden age of video games, it's been debated in the beginning to be somewhere between 1977 and 1978. A lot of people tend to point at the release of Space Invaders and the advent of vector displays, and they lead it all the way up to 1983, which is right up to the video game crash. So the golden period is going to be like, it butts up. It's kind of weird because it like, you know, there was the crash in 78. So people were kind of defining like the golden period between these two crashes. So this period saw a large growth in home gaming market when the second generation of gaming consoles kind of come up onto the scene, and then like, there's a large boom in microcomputer technology. Yeah, there's a quote from Michael's favorite, Mark J.P. Wolf, from his book, 2008, The Video Game Explosion, A History from Pong to PlayStation and Beyond, where he's quoted as saying, "The Golden Age was a time of great technical and design creativity in arcade games. The era saw rapid spread of video game arcades across North America, Europe, and Asia. The number of video game arcades in North America was doubled between 1980 and 1982. He had another quote from the same book saying the sales of arcade video game machines increased this period from 50 million in 1978 to 900 million in 1981. That's a lot of money.
Yeah. And of course, as we know, arcades are everywhere these days because they only continued to grow.
Yeah. You know, I go down to my local arcade all the time.
Yep. Some interesting things to note about kind of this time period, this moment of kind of exponential growth for the video game industry. A couple of these things we've already mentioned before, but I think are worth mentioning again. Nintendo released their first console in 1977. That's the Color TV Game 6, which I think we talked about in episode 3 or episode 6 or some other, whichever we talked about the 70s.
Yeah.
Callback to our very first, our episode 0, talking about Easter eggs, was 1979, Warren Robinett's Adventure came out, the game that was for a long time believed to have the first Easter egg in the video game industry. Brief reminder, he snuck it in there because he was concerned about lack of proper accreditation for actual developers in the video game industry kind of at that time, and so he felt like, you know, if he wasn't going to be acknowledged for the work that he was doing, he would like to have hidden his name in the game somewhere. And eventually people found it. Atari spun the whole thing to make it kind of a selling point of their games. And that's kind of how the modern Easter egg, and, you know, it was the first publicly acknowledged Easter egg. So it does have a spot in the history books.
Yeah. Yeah.
But as you mentioned, 78 was the year of Space Invaders, which was a game developed by Tomohiro Nishikado for the game company Taito. This was developed as a response to Atari's Breakout from 1976. It features a couple of things. I mean, it's a very science fiction-inspired shooting game. Nishikado apparently drew inspiration from War of the Worlds, as well as Star Wars, which he had seen apparently the year before. And one of the interesting things that a lot of people point to when it comes to how this game differed from some earlier arcade games is whereas a lot of other arcade games at the time had a more formal timer that would count down and kind of tell you when your time was up for playing Space Invaders actually just kind of used the aliens as kind of a timer. Like, the aliens would just get closer and closer until they killed you. And so there was a kind of a more organic way in which your play session would be ended rather than just a number running out.
Yeah, I remember I've played on an old Space Invaders cabinet before, and you know, like, you get the, it's like the dun dun dun, dun, and they speed up the more you like eliminate the aliens. So there's also like an interesting like skill level involved too. So like, you know, at first you have like this whole giant grid of aliens, and as you're shooting them, it's easy because like you're firing to a large crowd.
Yeah.
And as their numbers dwindle, they start picking up speed. So then it's like, you know, that provides like a really interesting like game design. Like, if you look at it from like a, I guess almost like the top down perspective of like what you're mentioning, where it's like, there's no timer. It's purely based on, can you clear all of this before they get to you?
Yeah. Or, I mean, it's also if they reach the bottom of the screen. Mm-hmm. So presumably, you know, they are invading, right? And so you're trying to get them, you're trying to keep them from reaching the planet. So right. There's a way in which if the aliens have gotten past you, it's not just that they've destroyed you, but it's that they've breached the perimeter and you've failed to keep them from invading Earth or something.
Yeah, kind of almost like kind of reminds me of another game, I guess, from like the same, like a little further down the time period, called like Missile Command, but like that game was more like Cold War-esque, where you're like trying to stop missiles from hitting cities. And I can't remember, there was a YouTube video where they talked about like the tension that game builds, because eventually it becomes a point where there's too many missiles on the screen to stop from hitting all the cities. And I'm like, wow, that's, I would be curious to see how the developer's intent went into that, because it's like, were they trying to make a point about like Cold War and like nuclear destruction, or like, is it just kind of like a game, like, you know, like we're talking about with Space Invaders, like, is this just this internal clock that's like speeding up to so it'd be kind of interesting to look into.
So it reminds me of Metal Gear Solid 5, you know, like the nuke mechanic for the online multiplayer. If you don't know, there's a weird mechanic in Metal Gear Solid 5 where everyone playing on the game can actually build nukes. And there, I think, was an achievement for full nuclear disarmament, because I think Kojima was trying to make an argument about, I guess, like kind of political argument about how to achieve global peace. Yeah. And I think people on the PS3 managed to do it, but on no other consoles.
That's crazy.
Because it required literally everybody who owned the game and was playing online to have deconstructed all of their nukes. So there would be no nukes online for at least one moment.
Wow.
I don't know. It's a random tangent.
That Kojima guy's kind of weird.
Yeah. So the year after Space Invaders, another notable game in the history of the video game industry, Asteroids. And Asteroids was conceptualized originally as a kind of cross between Computer Space and Space Invaders. If you remember Computer Space actually was the first coin-operated arcade game ever.
Yep.
Very popular from like the early 70s, inspired by Space War, which we've talked about very frequently on this podcast as being potentially one of the first video games, depending on, you know, a whole bunch of things.
Right.
This was made for Atari, and Asteroids very quickly became Atari's like best performing game ever at the time. And it knocked Space Invaders kind of off its peak from 78, because Space Invaders was incredibly popular for about a year. But then when Asteroids came out the year later, Asteroids kind of took its spot.
Yeah, and Asteroids is kind of neat. When I was a lot younger, we had we installed a game like collection on our home computer, and it had a bunch of like old school arcade games on there, and our Asteroids was one of them. And it's, you know, the game's like super bare bones. It's just like, you know, lines and this little triangle ship. It did have a really interesting function that you could like, I don't know what it looked like in the actual arcades, but like you could hit a button and like warp to a random point on the screen, mm-hmm. which sounds like a great idea until you warp into an asteroid. It had like
Space War had a similar mechanic.
Yeah. It also had like the physics were kind of neat because like everything had a lot more weight to it. Like flying the ship around was kind of fun. And then there was like a random little UFO would pop up and shoot at you every now and then. It was annoying as hell. So, yeah, it's always like a interesting little. I could see where like the popularity of it kind of like soared.
Yeah. Completely different from all of the kind of shooting games that were dominating arcades and the home console market at the time is a little game that you may have heard of called Puckman.
Oh, yeah. It's like a hockey player, right?
Yeah. Later renamed Pac-Man, originally in 1980 called Puckman. This game has perhaps one of the funniest justifications for developing a video game that I've ever heard that I stumbled upon while I was researching this. And this is actually just straight from the Wikipedia. I'm going to read it because it's written very well here. The Japanese video game industry had surged in popularity with games such as Space Invaders and Breakout, which led to the market being flooded with similar titles from other manufacturers in an attempt to cash in on the success. Side note, this is a very important reason why the crash eventually comes. But going back to the Wikipedia, Iwatani felt that... created by Toru Iwatani for Namco. Iwatani felt that arcade games only appealed to men for their crude graphics and violence, and that arcades in general were seen as seedy environments. For his next project, Iwatani chose to create a non-violent, cheerful video game that appealed mostly to women, as he believed that attracting women and couples into arcades would potentially make them appear to be much more family-friendly in tone. Iwatani began thinking of things that women liked to do in their time. He decided to center his game around eating, basing this on women liking to eat desserts and other sweets. His game was initially called Pakuman, based on the Japanese onomatopoeia term paku paku tabiru, referencing the mouth movement of opening and closing in succession.
Oh, yeah, because that's a great way.
As we know, women famously like to eat.
Still just so fucking random.
Yeah. You certainly, like, you know, as a man, I could never imagine eating.
Yeah, eating's not for me.
Yeah, eating's... You know, fellas, is it gay to eat? You know, like. But anyway, that's I guess what happened with Pac-Man. And Iwatani has talked a couple of times about like the justification for the Pac-Man design. He's often claimed, apparently, that the character of Pac-Man was designed after the shape of a pizza with a missing slice while he was at lunch. And he's later gone on to clarify other possible justifications for where Pac-Man came from.
It makes me laugh because, you know, 2 years later, Mrs. Pac-Man comes out, and Mrs. Pac-Man was literally a mod for Pac-Man developed in America. It's like,
right?
Can we not?
On that story, you would have thought that Miss Pac-Man would have been like the original.
Yeah,
you know, if it's meant to appeal to girl gamers,
right? Because we all know Pac-Man, the true feminist icon of the 1980s.
Apparently, I'm gonna start telling people that Pac-Man's a feminist icon.
Yeah, use that at your use that line at your next social gathering.
Yeah. Hey, any ladies in the room like to eat? you ever heard of a game called Pac-Man?
And now you're just ripping off Scott Pilgrim.
Yeah. That was 1980.
Mm-hmm.
In 1981, one of the most notable video games, maybe in the history of the video game industry, came out. And that was Nintendo's Donkey Kong. Donkey Kong has kind of an interesting history as well. Donkey Kong, notable for being both the first appearance of Donkey Kong, but also the first appearance of Mario, who was originally called Jumpman. Jumpman was originally, I guess, named for wanting to invoke a connection with other characters with man in their name, like Pac-Man, for instance. I guess it was decided that Jumpman would be an interesting name to, I guess, draw upon or establish a kind of continuity with these other games. It was sometimes cited as being the first game with a narrative that kind of plays out on screen, in that you actually see Donkey Kong kidnap Pauline,
yep,
is I believe the princess's name, and climb up to the top of the tower where you have to go rescue her.
They brought Pauline back in Mario Odyssey, and there's like a whole level that's like Donkey Kong themed.
That's funny.
Yeah,
I didn't play Odyssey, so I didn't actually know that. It was one of the first platforming games, though I think at the time, some articles mentioned that the press had taken to calling it a climbing game, because there was no such thing as a platformer at the time.
Right. At this point, we're just creating genres.
Yeah, basically, I mean, this is the Wild West, you know, everyone, it's a first come, first serve, everyone's trying to carve out a niche for themselves in the video game industry, so.
Right.
It's like the game controllers, you know? Shigeru Miyamoto, this was actually his debut as a lead game designer, Nintendo legend, and he cited a couple of influences for the game, actually Beauty and the Beast and King Kong among them. And actually, the connection to King Kong was believed to be so kind of, I guess, overt that Universal tried to sue Nintendo for Donkey Kong, claiming that it was too similar to King Kong.
Oh my god, I just had the funny realization that Universal's the one who just put out the Mario movie, weren't they?
Were they?
Let me see. Gotta look it up now. Brothers.
How the tables have turned.
It would have been last year. So it was. So I remember it was Illumination, because those are the people who, like the Minions.
Sure.
Oh, yep. Distributed by Universal Pictures.
Well, how the tables have turned.
Yeah.
I guess Universal won in the end, anyway.
Yeah.
So the name Donkey Kong, there's a lot of speculation about like why Donkey Kong. Vaguely, Miyamoto has suggested that the term was kind of meant to invoke this idea of stupid ape.
Yeah.
And I guess donkey was meant to just like, you know, this is a stupid monkey or something. And Mario, the reason that Jumpman was renamed to Mario is actually very funny in like an almost inconsequential kind of way. Apparently, the landlord of the original office space of Nintendo of America was named Mario Segale, and so they literally just named the character Mario after their landlord. And now Mario is like perhaps the most identifiable video game character of all time.
Wow. Yeah, I know that's the whole like Jumpman thing, and like you, I think you mentioned it the other day when we were going over the notes. Like you were like Beauty and the Beast. It was like we were talking about like, well, so does that make Mario Gaston?
Yeah, I guess. And that, in my mind, that makes Mario Gaston.
No one jumps like Mario.
I mean, they're both wearing red shirts, you know.
You might be onto something there. Mario might actually red just shirt. Be the villain.
Yeah. That or Gaston's the hero of Beauty and the Beast.
Oh, God. I also know that like, you had noted that in 81 was also Wolfenstein and Ultima, which we've talked about Ultima. And we will be talking about Wolfenstein and that stuff later, because that is also a very important game.
Yes, there's a lot of historically important things kind of happening all at the same time in the beginning of the 80s, or in the 80s in general. A lot to cover of different genres as well in their own developmental trajectories.
We weren't kidding when we said we're going to be here for a while.
Yeah. Another game that came out kind of around this time, 82, Pitfall, developed by David Crane for Activision. Crane was a former Atari employee who wanted to make a game that apparently had realistic graphics.
Oh,
and I guess that ended up in Pitfall, which, you know, is the... From today's perspective, is like the farthest thing from realistic, but I suppose at the time,
I had a friend that had an Atari 2600, and he had a copy of Pitfall, and I remember trying to play that thing.
Yes,
that's rough, and I don't know if you would call those alligators and scorpions realistic.
I'm not sure, but the game's setting was influenced by Raiders of the Lost Ark, which, you know, makes sense looking at it. And interestingly, Crane made a joke that the game design took only 10 minutes, but that it took like 1,000 hours of programming.
Wow.
Which is funny, you know, I mean, it is very simple of a game. And then the last specific game here that I've got some notes on that I want to talk about as being kind of notable in this time period. Right up until 83. And, you know, there's a ton of games in 83 that are worth talking about. Actually, the original Mario Brothers is in 83, which I figure, you know, at some point we'll probably have an episode on Nintendo, so I figure we'll save that for then. iRobot, which we talked about previously as being, I think, one of the first,
game
with 3D graphics. Yeah, the first game with 3D graphics.
Yeah, we watched that YouTube video and was like, this is insane.
Yeah, I would have had a seizure playing that game. I mean, like, it looked insane. But in 83, Bomberman also came out. And Bomberman, in particular, just has a very, very funny piece of trivia that I needed to share here, which is apparently that in 83, when Bomberman first came out, the game had an alternate title when it was released in Europe, called Eric and the Floaters.
It's the opening act for some band.
Bomberman, otherwise known as Eric and the Floaters.
You know, we all remember that was like, even when you brought it up, I was like, it was like one of those things of like, I didn't realize Bomberman was that old.
Yeah. I think the first Bomberman game I ever played, and maybe this is me showing how young I am compared to some people in this discourse, but I think the first Bomberman game that I played was for the Nintendo 64.
I think the first one I played was on the Super Nintendo, maybe. Or it might have been in N64, because I don't know if Bomberman was like really like widely like known in like my circles around that time, just because of just the gameplay. So
sure.
No, man, I gotta play some Eric and the Floaters.
Yeah. Eric and the Floaters, originally, I guess because in the European version of the game, you played as an Indiana Jones-style archaeologist named Eric, and the enemies were called floaters.
Gotcha.
And so I guess you had to drop bombs to excavate this, ancient temple and fight these floaters.
Okay. Well, cool.
So those are some of the more interesting, in my mind, games that kind of came out in this period that are worth noting. I mean, as you mentioned, also Ultima, Wolfenstein.
Yeah, games that we'll give brief mention to, but like we'll dive into more in later episodes because they're going to wind up being more significantly important for other subjects.
Yeah, I will also shout out here, 1980 was the original King's Quest.
Mm-hmm.
A1 also saw Frogger and Centipede.
Yeah, there was also Tempest, which was one of the first games to use color vector displays.
Yeah.
There's another one that I think we brought up. I can't remember. Oh, 1983 was Dragon's Lair, which was the first game to ever use Laserdisc in full animation cutscenes. So it makes like a brief appearance in Stranger Things. So.
Oh, really? I must have missed that.
Yeah. You see, like, the knight turning into a skeleton?
Yeah.
Yep, that's Dragon's Quest. So, I guess while, like, Michael brought up some of these like games on more like a micro level. Some of the macro stuff in the '80s, like on the larger scale, is also kind of fascinating. So like, you know, we brought up that like, you know, video games started showing up in supermarkets, restaurants, liquor stores, gas stations, tons of retail establishments, including you actually had arcades. By 1982, the video games accounted for 87% of an $8.9 billion in commercial game sales in the United States. Yeah, that's $8.9 billion in 1982.
That seems crazy to me for the 80s.
Yeah.
But, you know, I guess it's hard for me to conceptualize just how big video games... I mean, they were huge at this time.
Like in 1982, the arcade video game industry revenue in quarters was established at $8 billion, surpassing the annual grossing revenue of both pop music at $4 billion and Hollywood films at $3 billion combined that year. That's a lot of money in quarters.
Yeah.
It also exceeded revenues of all major sports combined at the time, earning three times the combined ticket and television revenues of the MLB, basketball, and American football, as well as earning twice as much as all casinos in Nevada combined.
That's wild. $8 billion in quarters would have to be $32 billion in quarters, right?
I don't know. That's some math right there.
Yeah, I'm surprised. I mean, I guess you don't need 32 billion quarters to exist in order for you to have 32 billion quarters worth of income, right? Because some of those quarters are being reused.
Yeah. You know, there was it's a rumor, but like, I think like when I first started like researching, it was like, well, like Space Invaders caused there to be like a coin shortage of 100 yen in Japan, but that was later to prove to be false. So, because like, it's just wild, but like also like, so during this time period, the Japanese video game manufacturers became increasingly influential in North America. And by 1980, they had become very influential through licensing of their games in American manufacturers. Japanese companies eventually would move beyond licensing their games to American companies such as Midway. And by 1981, instead began directly importing machines to North American markets, as well as building manufacturing facilities in the U.S. By 1982 to 1983, Japanese manufacturers had more directly captured a large share of the North American arcade market, which Gene Lipkin of the Data East U.S. partly attributed to Japanese companies having more finances to invest in new ideas. So, like, there's this period of time where, like, you know, Japan and America are both producing arcade cabinets, and eventually Japan's like, well, we keep exporting these. Why don't we just build them over there? And this is, so I think this is kind of the part where it starts to set the stage of Japanese game development starts to become a bigger deal because of what's going to happen. You know, where the American market's going to have some major problems, the Japanese market is very much untouched. So also around this time, the use of color in games takes huge leaps. You know, we mentioned that iRobot had 3D graphics, so RGB colors as well as vector displays. Even when I was talking about like Dragon Quest was using a Laserdisc machine. So, and then, so the next little part's kind of interesting because I think we kind of like touched on it a bit where like, you know, you brought up like the whole like Wild West of like genres and people were trying to make their mark. So, like, you know, with rapidly evolving hardware, all allowed new kinds of games, which allowed for different styles of gameplay. The term action games began being used in the 1980s in reference to new genres of character action games, which I mentioned this when we were talking about those, I think is the incorrect term to be using there. But so because that emerged from Japanese arcade developers who were drawing inspiration from manga and anime culture. According to Eugene Jarvis, these character-driven Japanese action games emphasize character development, hand-drawn animation and backgrounds, and to be more deterministic, scripted, and pattern type of play. Terms such as action characters and character games began being used to distinguish these new character-driven games from space shooters that had previously dominated the video game industry. The emphasis on character-driven gameplay, in turn, enabled a wider variety of subgenres. So, I think what they really mean here is kind of like what you were talking about with, like, Donkey Kong.
Mm-hmm.
Or, like, Space Invaders, aliens are invading, there's, like, no central story. and Space Invaders as versus like Donkey Kong, where it's like this guy's trying to rescue this woman from an ape, like a giant ape. Because my brain reads character action games, and I go like, oh, like Bayonetta or like, you know, right, Devil May Cry. Like, is Jumpman gonna whip out some like dual pistols and like do a Michael Jackson moonwalk dance on, and then like get into like a 45-minute cutscene battle with Donkey Kong?
Yeah.
So
yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, if this was such a time for, I don't know, innovation, like the rules had not been laid down yet, so there were kind of no solid genre expectations, except that, you know, people knew that shooting games were popular.
I think it's kind of worth to start like thinking about like how, then we'll get into this like in later episodes, but like, you know, it even mentions that like Japanese development started going towards more hand-drawn animation backgrounds and scripted events and pattern types, as to where like American design at the time was more like building a game that would be easy to play and be like faster to like develop for like monetary reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know this for sure, but it's like one of those things of like, the more I think about it, it's like, if you're drawing influence from anime and manga, or like, you know, written material and like visual medium at the time, you're probably going to take more of the knowledge of the storytelling element versus how can we make money the fastest, you know?
Yeah. No, that makes sense. And maybe that explains, you know, why Japan was not so unfortunate with, you know, the crash.
Meanwhile, like, and if you think about it as well, like, on the other front of the home computer market, and we've already kind of touched on this when we talked about D&D, it was trending more towards story driven stuff.
Yeah.
Versus like, you know, quick play, you know, playing these like shooter style games, which are, because, you know, also around this time you've got like, you know, Space Invaders was so popular, then you get like Galaxian and Galaga just like show up on the screen, and those are more like Midway and Atari products. So a little bit more like focused around like, you know, American style, like developing. It definitely would be something worth like looking into about this time period, where like how development was prior to and then post crash.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, there was some other stuff that was going on around the time, to the point where like video games were influencing pop culture, as well as like there were like music albums talking about even like sampling parts of games. Also this time period introduced the movie Tron, which also had like an arcade cabinet that did better than the movie did.
Interesting.
And Tron was the first movie to ever use CGI graphics in a movie. So also around this time, and I'm actually going to be able to read some of this, is this was the time around the first publications for video centered around video games. You even had strategy guides, you know, those things where you used to go on the game FAQs and they had these cool ASCII drawings at the top. You spent hours scrolling through them. Yeah, those things. and there was one, the two most popular ones in the time was a book called Mastering Pac-Man, which, funny enough, has sections dedicated to how you're supposed to route yourself through the maze. I'm going to read one out real quick, because I read it earlier while we were sitting around like getting ready. Yeah. It's like, let me find one of the shorter ones real quick. Yeah, so on chapter 6, it's called Pattern P2, and it says, also this was written by Ken Utzon. This was produced in 1981 and sold 1,700,000 copies. So Pattern P2 is designed for the first board of the fast game and the second strawberry board of the slow game. It is simple to learn because the monsters are moving slowly during these boards. P2 is designed to yield the player fairly high scores from these boards since, if properly executed, all four blue monsters are eaten after E4 is hit, giving the player 3,000 in bonus points. The P2 concept, Step one, clear out the most of the lower portion of the board and converge on E4 just before the monsters do. Step two, hit E4 and eat all four blue monsters. Step three, proceed north and eat the right S channel. Step four, proceed to quadrant three, clear all the dots, and eat E3. Step five, proceed north to quadrant one, clear the quadrant and eating E1. Step six, clear the left S channel. Step seven, finish up quadrant two and eat two, and then seven dots in quadrant four. And it even has like diagrams. So I think I said it weirdly this earlier. I'm like, this is just speed running.
Yeah. And it's always interesting to me. And I guess I have to think about this in terms of game guides as well. Like, first of all, the fact that it sold as many copies as it did is insane to me.
Yeah. How many pages was it? 162 pages.
It's 162. Like, I just can't imagine somebody spending money. I mean, maybe it was cheap, right?
Yeah.
But part of me also I suppose the more rational part of my brain wants to say, is it really fun? Like, if this is just telling you exactly what you need to do and the steps you need to do it in order to get the score, is it really fun? Like, are you actually playing Pac-Man at that point, or are you just like executing a series of directions that you've been given in order to achieve an outcome? I don't know, like to impress people at the arcade who don't also own the book, because otherwise then they know the strategy as well.
Man, you gotta if it's Pac-Man, you gotta impress the ladies because they gotta know that you can eat a lot.
That's true. I forgot that Pac-Man was bringing the ladies into the arcades.
Yeah.
So if there was an important game to be good at.
It's also kind of like weird to think about. And like, I haven't read enough in this to determine, but like, so we know nowadays that like the four ghosts in Pac-Man actually have like designated patterns. And so like, were these people creating these strategies? Did they know that? Or were they just, have they played it so much that they understand it? Or is this like a grift where someone's just like, is making something up, you know? And yeah, selling it. So the other book that I found was called it was called How to Master the Video Games by Tom Hirschfeld. It was also from 1981, but it only sold 650,000 copies, and it is specifically about, it has like a wide array of like genre subjects. Like, I think the table of contents, let's see here. The table of contents even says, like, it breaks it down into, like, different categories. Like, chapter one is, like, for beginners only. Chapter two is know your enemy. Chapter three, seven steps to mastery. And then it's, like, space invader type games. And it lists, like, Centipede, Galaxian, Space Invaders. Space Invaders Part 2. Apparently there was a Part 2. Then it has like asteroid type games where it has like Asteroids, Defender, Scramble, Space Odyssey. And then it's like maze games. It includes Pac-Man. And then it has like reflex games, miscellaneous games. Chapter 9, and the one that I want to read something from, is called Exercises That You Can Do to Get Better at Video Games. And
yeah, I need to know these because I hurt my back the other day just sitting at my computer for like 3 days straight.
Let's see here. Here we go. So, off-machine exercises. Physical adeptness is essential to implementing your strategies. In your spare time, you and a friend can work on improving hand-eye coordination, peripheral vision, finger strength, and tempo control. The exercises can be enjoyable, challenging, and will sharpen skills just as effectively as the first few quarters you put into a game you want to learn. They should be adjusted to the player's abilities and needs. When playing arcade games for any amount of time, remember to keep your back and neck straightened, relaxed, but straight, thus avoiding stiffness and cricks. And this first little section I'll read is, it just talks about like a hand exercise. It's like, you will accomplish wonders by training your hands to react as quickly as possible to visual stimulus. Exercise. Have your friend drop a pen from various heights from 4 to 7 feet. Stand a foot away and keep your right hand at your side until you see the pen drop. Then reach and catch it before it hits the ground. See diagram. The different heights are necessary to prevent you're relying more on reflex than actual coordination. When you have made 10 clean catches in a row with each hand, let your friend try. So yeah, and then there's like, there's a section on eyes, fingers, and tempo. Ugh.
It's... Even more than the Pac-Man book, this just sounds like a grift, you know, like...
Yeah.
It must have been so easy to make money in the 1980s. Like, you could literally just publish whatever you wanted.
What was it I read? Oh, yeah. I don't know when this actually, or, like, what this actually includes. Oh, this was in 1988. But there was, like, a strategy guide for, like... Surprisingly enough, like, strategy guys make like tons of money. Like, the Pokemon strategy books apparently earned revenue of $142 million. But the most, I think, in the time period, there was one in 1985 that came out after the crash. That's the complete Super Mario Brothers strategy guide, and it sold 1,300,000 copies. So, like. These books are insane. Like, it's the amount that they're selling them for. Like, so yeah. Yeah. So,
I mean, when I grew up, my brother and I, we used to always buy the Legend of Zelda strategy guides for pretty much every Zelda game we played.
Yeah.
And I have a soft spot personally for the Elder Scrolls strategy guides. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember there would be, I had the one for Oblivion and then I had the one for Skyrim. Where I think the one for Skyrim maybe actually even came out before Skyrim released. I'm not entirely sure. But I know that around that time period, I was like on vacation or something, and I didn't have access to my Xbox or to my PC to play the game. And so I remember there was a while where I was just reading the Oblivion strategy guide, just like, you know, fantasizing about how I would play the game when I got to finally like go home.
Yeah. Well, like, I think I had the strategy guide for Majora's Mask, and then I got the one that includes Zelda 1, Zelda 2, and Ocarina of Time Master Quest. So, like, and not to mention, like, you would buy, like, you know, in the 90s, I remember buying, I think it was Game Informer, or there was another one, too, that I bought. And I think it ran out of print, but I remember buying it because it had the cheat codes for GoldenEye.
Nice.
And it was just like, you know, that used to be a thing. Or like what I mentioned earlier, where like people would go to GameFAQs and you would look up these like long, like detailed like text files that people had wrote. And it's like, you know, nowadays you just go to YouTube and just, oh, I'm stuck on a boss. Type in the boss and like, people are like, oh, yeah. This is how you beat this boss.
The internet has kind of taken the place of, you know, like the physical game guide, which in some ways is a shame because I think that game guides are such an interesting media thing. You know, it's like, it's so, it exists for like 3 decades and then it's become utterly irrelevant. You know, I'm not even sure if they still make game guides anymore.
I wouldn't think they would. I think nowadays, like, I mean, shoot, like, look at, like, how fighting game characters come out now. You'll have, like, a fighting game character gets announced, and then there's, like, a trailer, and then there's, like, a breakdown of what all the character can do.
Yeah, I think, yeah, the internet has just made it irrelevant. But I still use the internet. I mean, like, you know, whenever I'm not playing a game right when it's come out, I mean, I definitely look up help sometimes, you know, if I'm playing Dark Souls or Dark Souls 3, sometimes I'll go on the wiki and I'll say, hey, how do I find this particular weapon?
That's what I was just thinking about. Is like, I remember, so I, you know, I never played Dark Souls 1 on release. I played the remaster, but like, you know, I always hear the stories about people playing DS1 and not knowing anything. And you know, this communal effort of people like sharing information about DS1 to find stuff.
Yeah.
So like, Lord, if it wasn't for a friend of ours telling me that you could go back to the Undead Asylum, I never would have done it.
Yeah.
So. But yeah,
it's... I mean, that's playing Elden Ring on release was like such a special experience kind of because of the... I could, like, even if I wanted to look things up, you know, like, people just hadn't found the information yet.
Yeah. Oh, man. Looking forward to June. DLC.
Yeah. Very exciting. And so I, maybe like to my earlier comment too, I'll just briefly say, like, it is weird to me because on the one hand, my brain thinks, how is that fun if you're just looking up exactly what you need to do in order to succeed?
Mm-hmm.
But then, like, I very frequently have fun with video games. I, you know, have the solution to a puzzle spoiled for me. That's like, it's still, I guess, fun to go through and do it yourself in a weird kind of way that I'm not really sure why, but.
Or it's like,
it is
like in a Souls game where like after you beat it, you go and like look up all these weapons and like come back through and you have built like you in your head, you've got like the perfect build in your head. And just like, but like, you know, I guess it's kind of like there's, you know, during this time period, you know, arcades, I mean, I remember arcades in like the 90s doing the thing of like putting quarters on the arcade screen to say you were next. And, you know, I assume that that's kind of what happened during this time period as well. It would be really neat. And it would be something to like look into is to find some folks who like in that age range who went to arcades during this time period to see what the culture was like and just like talk to someone. It's like at this point we're only like reading text, but like and like reading information and books that people have written is to like hear like verbatim stories of like going to the arcade, you know, spending quarters and like trying to beat a game or something. Because, you know, like, you know, Pac-Man does, you know, the true end screen of Pac-Man is like a jumbled mess because it runs out of memory.
Right.
So, but yeah. So,
I want to say briefly, per our discussion of publications in this time period, we mentioned in episode 9 when we were giving our overview of the 80s that 81 is when the first video game magazine is published in the United States, Electronic Games. Which then later got renamed to Computer Entertainment in 83 and then canceled in 85, unfortunately. But
okay.
And in 84 was the first kind of scholarly text written on a video game, or one of the first, Chris Crawford's The Art of Computer Game Design. Which is scholarly, recognized as kind of the first scholarly book interested in talking about video games as an art form. This is almost 20 years before video game studies would go on to be recognized as like a sort of academically legitimate discourse. In 84, Crawford's book was the first book devoted to theorizing about video games and asked what games were and why people played them. Crawford presented an argument that computer games constitute a new and as yet poorly developed art form that holds great promise for both designers and players. And it's very interesting to me, you know, somebody who grew up playing video games in the late 90s, early 2000s. You know, it's like in 84, these people are talking about Pitfall and Donkey Kong.
Yeah.
And it's so crazy to me because I look at these games and they seem like the furthest thing in my mind from art.
Right.
But, you know, I have to put myself back in the headspace of like being someone in the 80s and thinking, just thinking about, I guess, like, or speculating about the potential that the medium had to go beyond things like Donkey Kong and Pitfall.
Yeah.
So
it's wild to me, and it's going to be kind of fun as we get closer to the 90s and closer to the time period in which like I grow up, and then like, you know, we catch up to like you playing, to where you watch this like rapid evolution of like game design from like even now, like it just like talking about this like brief time period, there are already people who in their heads, they want to tell a story.
Right.
But they want, you know, I guess the better way to think about it, like, is like, it's like the medium itself, like the interactivity of like games, like being able to tell that story through that. And like, you're already kind of seeing it, like it's starting to happen. And then how we go from like these little steps here and there to like, you know, the rapid, like, and how fast suddenly we get there.
Yeah.
It'll be really interesting, especially like when we get to like kind of the big, you know, RPG stuff. You know, my brain always goes to like Final Fantasy.
Right.
So, and then not to mention all of the computer stuff that's happening. Like, you've already had Wolfenstein show up. And like at this point, id's like in the works. It's beginning its process to make its way to kind of revolutionize what's happening in the home computer market.
So. Yeah.
But yeah, those will be stories for other times. So, But any final thoughts on the Golden Age here, Michael, before we wrap up?
No final thoughts, except if I said something, that would be a final thought. Oh, I think I got everything out of my system that I needed to.
Okay, sweet. So you won't have to wait long for our next episode, because we're going to kind of do two this month back to back, because our next one is, it's our 1 year anniversary show. We have officially will have made it a whole year, and we're going to be talking about the OG, I call it the OG Souls game, but it's not, but we're going to be talking about a game called Rogue, mainly because of the fascination that we've kind of found with it as a game that started off, kind of stayed quiet for a long time, and then in about the last 10 years, the name Rogue has cropped up everywhere. So we're going to ask the question as to why that is, and we're going to spend a whole episode kind of talking about it.
Yes, if you've ever heard of a genre called a roguelite or a roguelike, you have heard of Rogue.
And so we're going to kind of talk about that and talk about its influence as well as, kind of moving forward. So, yeah, I guess the schedule moving forward is our next episode will be our 1 year anniversary show. And then in May, we will finally be arriving at the video game crash.
Yes.
We'll be talking about what led up to it, the factors, some of its effects. And as we've kind of mentioned, it might take us more than one episode to actually like fully talk about everything that happens with the crash. In the month of June, we have an open episode. We haven't really discussed what we're going to do yet, but we'll be working on that. In July, we'll probably still be talking about the crash, but we'll also begin discussions about Japanese game development during this time period and how Japanese game development affects things going forward. And then in August, we have another open month in September. We'll probably still be doing another history episode, probably going along the lines of the same, still talking about the fallouts of the crash. Maybe we'll start kind of dipping our toes into a small little company called Nintendo. So, and that's kind of like
small indie company.
Yeah, just a little small. They made card games, right?
Yeah.
And like some handhelds. So, but anyway, that's the show for today. Thank you all for tuning in and listening. I guess before we go, Michael will tell us where the people can find you and any other little plugs you'd like to throw out.
Same places, Instagram, mackerel_prawns. I don't use Twitter anymore, so just Instagram, I would say.
Yeah.
And also, check out my friend's podcast. Yeah. You can find me on my friend's podcast.
Yeah.
In Bed with Books.
So sweet. You can find me on Instagram for my art, press art F4. I haven't been doing a whole lot of art lately. I'm kind of like on a small break, but I also do twitch.tv/backwardshero. The instruction booklet has its own Twitch channel. Who knows, we might try and play Rogue. Also, Caging Greatness has returned. We just did, by the time this episode's out, the caging episode for Between Worlds will be out. Oh god, that movie was, yeah, that was a movie. Bluff. And then our next episode should be Dream Scenario, which was very good. You can also find everything about the instruction booklet on linktr.ee/instruction booklet. From there you'll find all of our plugs, from Michael's Instagram to my Twitch to my art. You can even find the instruction booklet's Twitter and Facebook page. Be sure to follow those. I think we'll be expanding at some point into Instagram. I gotta get that set up. And also, like, a nice shout out to the AICH network that hosts us. You can find us there and all of their great shows. So yeah, and then as like Michael said, go be sure to check out the In Bed with Books episode that he's on, and listen to him talk about Changeling.
Yay.
So anyway, thank you all for listening, and be sure to tune in next month as we talk about Rogue, or next episode as we talk about Rogue.
Yep. So. Thanks everyone.
All right, bye.